This is our 559th episode of the Dave's Gone By radio program of the air, here live on this May 28th, 2016. I'm Dave Lefkowitz. I was just with my darling and adorable wife, Joyce. And it's kind of cool that Joyce and I do this show together on Saturday mornings. Because, you know, I do comedy and she joins in there. She's you know, a serious assistant professor here at the university. But, you know, we try and do some comedy together. These guys do comedy together and apart all the time. Al Ducharme and Bernadette Pauly, they are comedians. They're married. They've been doing this for quite a few years now. You've seen her. Let me just find her particulars. She is on. Oh, by the way, you guys are back on. Your mic is on. You are with us in the neighborhood. So thank you so much for calling. And as I said, they're at the Brokerage Pub in Belmore, Long Island. And this is what I don't understand. You guys are playing two different places on the same night? Is that what's happening?
That's why our marriage is so successful.
Because you're.
Because I'll be performing at McGuire's in Bohemia,
uh-huh.
Night 7 and 9, and Bernadette or Bernie will be performing at the Brokerage in Belmore at 8, 7:30, and 9:30.
Time apart, it keeps it fresh. And sometimes he's in Hong Kong and I'm in Alaska, and that's how we keep it alive.
That is way cool. I thought you were traveling, you know, at the same places together, but you're branching off to different places on Long Island tonight. So, first of all, how did you meet on the circuit, as it were?
We did. We met in New York City at the Comic Strip Live on the Upper East Side many years ago. We were friends. We were hanging out with the same group of comedians, and then we kind of put it all together after the 9/11 incident. So here we are.
Wait, what does the 9/11 incident have to do with anything?
I think it was just the time things were going on in the city. We were drawn to one another, and I think
he pretty much means we were a 9/11 hookup. We knew each other for years and worked on the circuit, but never dated. But after 9/11, we were all hanging in the city at the comedy clubs, and nobody could go anywhere, and kind of time stood still for a little bit, and we kind of started dating because we figured, hey, if the world is ending, let's hook up.
Oh, I was wondering about that. I was like, you know, because I was thinking maybe the airplane went into the towers, and he was like, well, I want to plow into her. I was wondering how that kind of happened there.
Sorry, I wasn't articulate enough, but yeah, you get the idea. I didn't want to say hookup, but she did.
Yeah, she did. She used that word. Okay, and that so you guys have been together since 2001, 2002. When did you get married?
When did we get married?
2004.
That's
yeah.
Right. So it will be 12 years in August, and I will say it's been a glorious, I would say, a glorious 9 years out of the 12.
Yeah, I pretty much agree with that summation.
Fair enough. So, but let me ask, is it harder or easier? I guess for you guys it's easier being married to someone in the exact same profession, doing the exact same kind of thing.
Well, I don't think that works for everyone, that dynamic, but for us it does, because we understand the animal. We understand that there's a lot of travel involved. We do get to work together, and we do have our separation, so it's a kind of a fine balance for us, and it seems to work for both of our personalities.
And can I, it's really none of my business, but do you plan on having youngins, or is that, you know, because that could really make the picture very different.
That's for another episode.
Okay, well, I'm just saying, you know, you can travel. Yeah, sorry.
No, we're raising a 12-pound chihuahua right now, and that's a lot of work. So we'll see what else happens.
But we're priming for that. So we just have to see what the logistics are going to look like over the next 18 to 24 months.
Yeah.
Oh.
And then we're going to we'll text you.
You do. So you got, well, let me ask, I'm wondering about this, because you know, especially Al, but you probably do too, Bernadette, the New York comedy clubs, the famous ones, the Dangerfields, the Caroline, you played them. Are there different vibes in the different clubs? Do you have a different feeling when you go into each different one, be it Comic Strip Live or Gotham, or, you know, does each one have a special sort of feeling to it?
Yeah, sure. Each one has its own individual comedy culture and personality of its own, and you may perform differently for that. The clientele may be a little different, and you have to make adjustments for that, but that's what we do for a living. We do that constantly when we travel anyway, so it's not new to us. It's not foreign to us.
Well, do you each have a favorite club?
Yeah, but if we tell you, then the other clubs might stop using us.
Or let's make believe it's not a New York club. What about one outside New York?
My all-time, for me personally, my favorite place in the world to perform is the Sand Comedy Clubs in Scotland. And
oh.
They have one in Ireland, and now they have one in the UK as well. And for whatever reason, it's a great club. The audiences are magical, and they have a great respect for comedy.
Huh.
I'm going to say a little bit more domestic on that. I love many of the clubs. Some of my favorite clubs are gone now. They no longer exist.
But, like which?
I do like the Ice House and Comedy and Magic Club on the West Coast.
Hmm.
And just about any club here in Manhattan is just always a joy to get in front of that New York crowd, whether it's a foreigners or Bridge and Tunnel people or just native New Yorkers. They're just great audiences all around.
Now, that's something for you to say, because when you say you guys travel, you seriously travel doing comedy, not just for vacation, but you've been doing these comedy festivals in the most far-flung corners of the world. So I had to ask, there's a Dubai comedy festival, and tell us about that.
Well, just the basic of it, we were able to travel, perform for different audiences.
Yeah.
And see these different cultures. And, again, some of it is quite strange and unusual, but the experiences have been phenomenal. We feel very fortunate. We're able to travel the world and do our job without having to carry a rifle or answer to a sergeant. So that's a good thing.
Well, wait a minute. You did comedy in Beirut. I would imagine you would have felt comfortable holding a rifle.
That's an oxymoron, you would think.
Yeah.
Actually, the Lebanese, both Christian and Muslim, and a small percentage of Jewish audience members were in harmony when it comes to comedy. That's one of the great things about comedy, for the most part. It's subjective, of course, but it can really, I know it sounds corny, it brings people together. We're all doing the same thing.
Yeah.
We're there to have a good time and laugh.
Yeah.
There you go.
Are there jokes that you had to cut out, either because of content or just because they wouldn't get it because they're not from New York, not from America, not from Massachusetts?
Oh, absolutely. When I went to Saudi Arabia, I had to sign a death form. It said death form, and I wasn't allowed to talk about religion, politics, or say anything that would hurt the feelings of anybody of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
So can I ask why you would... You know, this bothers me a little bit. Why would you go to these places? They're not really our friends. Why would you go there?
Well, it's our mission to bring this world together.
Because there's a check waiting, and we have a bill to pay.
Yeah, we were compensated for our...
Well, I'm sure going to Dubai, you were very well compensated. The Arab countries have more money than we do. But I just, they're... I mean, if North Korea asked you to come and do comedy, would you?
I would, just for the experience of it, just to go there and see for myself. I mean, because we do see, we see the news, we see, I don't know what's propaganda, what's factual. I like to see things for myself. And if I have that opportunity where I can come back intact, I will do that. And right now there's a lot of places in the world that are, dangerous to go to, but at the same time... I mean, there's certain places I may not go, depending on what's going on, uprisings and such, but I want to see for myself. I want to make my own judgment.
I mean, I think that's pretty fair. Have you ever been to a place where you feared a little bit for your safety?
Yeah.
Where?
I mentioned I'm married. I live in, and, sure. I mean, there were parts of the Middle East, Afghanistan, Afghanistan, I'm in no hurry to go back there. I probably would if I was performing for the troops again. But I also did a private sector and State Department people that I performed for there. And we had to go off the green zone area and into some remote areas. And I'm not too big on doing that again, but, you know, I guess I could be persuaded. But I had to wear, you know, the helmet and
sure.
The armor, body armor, et cetera. And I actually, after a few days there, I started taking my body armor off because I felt like I was a target. And I actually was, I had a little less anxiety once I took my armor off, believe it or not.
And you didn't see any fire or any, I mean, it was totally fine when you were there.
Well, there were incidents, and there were incidents certainly before and bigger ones after we left. But I didn't do any bombing.
Oh, no. You didn't bomb, literally or figuratively.
Too easy, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I you had to go there. Now, Bernadette, speaking of going to dangerous places, you moved from New York to Los Angeles when you, you know, married Al and wanted to make a life and career in comedy out there. Was that a big switch for you?
It was a very, very big switch. It's a very dangerously superficial place, but I keep my mind as best I can when I'm out there. I moved there. I had a TV hosting gig. I was asked to host
Gossip Queens.
Show.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and then it got renewed, and it was silly, all the traveling back and forth. And we thought, well, we've been told forever you've got to do L.A. So we just we relocated there. But for me personally, my heart is in New York City. It always is. When I touch ground here, I feel grounded and I hit the ground running. And I always, you know, this is always home for us, no matter what.
Cool. I mean, I should say that I lived in New York all my life until moving out to Colorado, which is where we are now. But, you know, there is obviously something about New York that L.A. doesn't quite have. But I want to ask you also about, Bernadette, about some of the jobs that you had while you were struggling and trying to make it in the business. The usual stuff, you know, waitressing and all that. But you mentioned in your bio online, you were a cigarette girl. What the hell is that?
I was a cigarette girl down on Wall Street, and people would buy $18 martinis, and I would sell them overpriced cigarettes and Cuban cigars, fake Cuban cigars, and
Well, I mean, you would just be on the floor of the stock exchange walking around with stuff?
No, then what did you say?
We were walking around the floor of the stock exchange selling this stuff.
No, but we actually would go over to the stock exchange sometimes. Another thing that I would do, because the cocktail lounge was down there, is whenever they had a brand new product come out on Wall Street, they would go have us stand there in like little hats or whatever. They'd give us a little outfit touting the product, and we'd give free stuff away, whether it was little hats or candy bars, you know, whatever was coming out. And it's so funny because the Wall Street guys would be in their $4,000 suits with their Rolexes, but they were absolute animals when it came to anything free. So, and I remember the first day I did it, because, you know, you're working in a cocktail lounge and you think, how bad could it be? And people, I remember the woman that brought us over, we would do it every once in a while, and she said, listen, they're going to stampede you. You have to be safe. And these men would literally, to get a free baseball cap, climb over each other, step on your feet. Oh, my God, it was like filing the basement at its worst moment.
Well, I mean,
I remember being on the floor. I don't know if you've ever been on the floor.
No,
but
no.
I said, oh, my God, they're like little chipmunks running around, or like they were just scurrying everywhere like New York City rats, and it was so fast. And I said, wow. I said, it's amazing one of them doesn't drop dead of a heart attack.
I'm sure they do. You know.
They do. Somebody said, please keep that down because it actually happens quite often.
Yeah.
I was like, wow.
And the thing is, you know, they don't die. They just kill the economy. That's their job.
Exactly. Yeah, it's true. And they love to gamble. They would gamble down on Wall Street when they were waiting for an elevator because they gamble with other people's money. They would literally place a bet. They'd be like, I'll bet you $100 that elevator 2 gets here first. It was insane.
Wow.
It was really insane.
I just realized this is only the second time in my life that I have spoken to a rabbi.
Oh, actually, do you want to talk to the rabbi? This is Dave. I'm the host of the radio program.
Oh, okay. I'm so sorry. My confusion. I'm looking at my notes here.
Oh, yeah, no, but the rabbi has been, I would love to bring him on. to talk to you guys because he's been waiting. You called in when I was in the middle of a segment, so I thought I'd just roll into the next segment. But I can bring Rabbi Saul Solomon in. It'll just take me about a minute. I can play one of your routines that we have recorded. So if you guys can just hold, I'll put you on hold. And
okay, excuse me. The first time I spoke to a rabbi, it was a fender bender in front of a synagogue, so this would be great.
I'm sure he would love to hear about that. So hold on. I'm going to put you guys back on hold for about a minute and a half. And meanwhile, we're going to play a piece from... let's play... Hold on. Let me get my iTunes working again. Thank God for YouTube, so I was able to find this. Here's Bernadette Pauly live talking, since we're talking about Wall Street and stuff. She still has a little bit of residual anger about those years. Here's Banks and Credit from Bernadette Pauly, and Rabbi Saul Solomon will join us in just a moment. Bernadette Pauly on the radio, as well as Al Ducharme here in the neighborhood with me, Rabbi Saul Solomon, the founder and spiritual leader of Temple Sons of Bitches in Great Neck, New York. I'm on Long Island and very excited to say that on Long Island tonight, you can see in two different places, Al Ducharme and Bernadette Pauly. Please remind us, guys, which one is where?
Hi, Rabbi Saul Solomon.
Shalom. Shalom, damn it to you. So...
rabbi names right there.
Now, but before we talk about that car accident thing, remind me where, who is at the brokerage and who is at Governor's?
That's a good question. Bernadette Pauly will be at the brokerage in Belmore, two shows this evening, and I will be at McGuire's Comedy Club. These are all Governor's Comedy Clubs, part of the Governor's chain, and that's in Bohemia.
Whoa. Yeah. Laurel and Hardy were there. At one point.
Well, you can tether your cow or your horse right out front.
Now, speaking of cows and horses and transportation, you mentioned, I heard you talking to Dave, saying that you met a rabbi one other time when you bumped into a car. What happened?
I don't know. Should I run with this or should I just...
You have no choice now. Yes.
All right. It was my attempt at making a bad joke from the confinements of my hotel room in New York.
So this did not actually... So you've never talked to a rabbi before? Ever?
Yeah, but not a Rabbi Saul Solomon. I mean, that's the real deal.
Well, are you circumcised at least?
I can send a picture, but I don't know if that's appropriate.
No. With the movie Wiener coming out, I don't think you should do that. What were you about to say, Bernadette?
I was going to say, yes, he is.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, thank you. Thank you for sharing.
I'm here for clarification.
and some other things, too, since you were the one with the hookup. But, you know...
I lost my knighthood, yes.
Now, both of you... what are your backgrounds, by the way? Ducharme, are you of French origin or something?
Ducharme... Can I do this? Yeah, okay. Can I do this?
Yeah.
It's of French origin. Yes, my grandmother's maiden name was Ducharme. It means of charm, so it's Al of Charm. I changed it a few years back because I was having a lot of trouble getting comedy work with my real last name, which is Kider. And with the name Al Kider, it's very difficult.
No,
that's a joke.
That is a joke. Oh, I got it. All right. I get it. Okay, so you are of French. And what about Pauly? You are no relation, I assume, to Jane Pauly.
No, everybody always asks me that.
Of course.
I wish I were a relation to Jane Pauly. I'd hit her up for a regular gig. But no, I'm no relation.
Well, at what point did you, both of you, were you able to stop doing those kinds of cigarette girl jobs? Because I remember, Al, when you were a cigarette girl. And when were you able to just do comedy or just do acting, just do stuff in the business?
For me, that happened when I mean, there were a few times that were touch and go. Well, Al's been doing nothing but comedy for a good 20 years or so.
Right.
Yeah, 25
years. Yeah, so that's been his main gig. He had side jobs in college, but straight out of college, comedy became his main shtick. And for me, I had a million side jobs, and there were a few times when I booked a bunch of colleges and such higher paying gigs, but then it would dry up, and I would need another gig. But the thing that helped me just kind of move away from any side gig was, what year was it? In 2010, I was working in the UK with Al, actually, and I got a call for a TV hosting gig in LA.
Whoa.
So for me, it's been full-time only about 5 years, but I've been doing it over 15.
All right. Well, that's still pretty darn good, you know, to build and then have a regular career where you know your agent will call you with a list of things to do from month to month to month. Are you both at that stage?
We call them with a list of things to do from day to day to day.
Yes, exactly. And if you don't call them, it won't get done.
No, wait, but then how do you book your... how do you go from just doing open mics at 2 a.m. at Governor's or Caroline's or Brokerage or wherever the heck it is to being like, oh, we have to go to Scotland next month to perform at this gig and we're being paid?
Well, it's a business, and the business model has changed drastically with the invent of social media. So from the way we did it, our grassroots way, was getting in front of the right people who may book shows, meeting agents, cold calling.
Really?
And trying to impress people, et cetera, sending out VHS tapes, DVDs. It was, you know, true grassroots marketing, et cetera. But now, if you have 100,000 followers on Twitter, you can probably book a weekend somewhere, even if you're not that funny.
Oh, well. How do you get 100,000 followers on Twitter?
But you know what I found, like, to be honest with you, yes, it's very political, and you have to be very methodical, which a lot of artists aren't, and I wasn't we weren't for a long time.
We're not bitter.
But the other thing is, I've always found, to be honest with you, that work begets work.
Absolutely.
You could do a free gig at a cancer ward, and someone, you know, because you just want to do something nice. And someone will be there and say, hey, will you come perform at my corporate event? And so you never know what job you're doing that's going to end up bringing you work. I did a late night spot at the Boston Comedy Club for like four drunk people, and there happened to be a TV writer in the back, and my first little tiny baby hosting job was for late night on TBS. This was like 14 years ago. And he literally said, we're having a hard time finding someone. Would you come in tomorrow and read?
Wow.
I mean, being the only comedian who wanted to sit around and wait until one in the I didn't know that he was in the back of the room. And if I blew that $10 spot off late at night, then maybe I wouldn't have gotten that hosting gig.
So it's just being there again and again and not going away. And just being, what was it that Joe Franklin used to say? You have to be nice, but be persistent, but be nice, but be persistent. It's the whole deal.
Exactly. Another thing is, a friend said to me years ago, be politely nudgy. And it's so true. Be politely nudgy.
Well, I'm nudgy to a fault. I don't know about the politeness, but you know, that's the hell I live in. Speaking of hell, and you've been to hell, you've been to the Arab world, but let me ask you about hell gigs. Because we have a radio station, believe it or not, out in Colorado that is devoted completely to comedy. All they do is play stand-up. And what they do for the interstitials is that they ask comedians what their worst hell gig ever was. So, guys, go.
Tonight.
Nice. Nice.
No, it's nice.
I have many war stories. Let me see if I can conjure up a brief one. Maybe you can press it, condense it here. You have one on your mind. Go right ahead, and I'll jump in a minute.
I don't know. I have a few really, really bad hell gigs. Many years ago when I first started out and I had no right being there, I opened up for a very, like, hip-hop, belligerent black crowd.
And when you say opened up, you just mean you started the show. You didn't, kidding.
Yes, I was one of, like, five comics on the lineup before this huge guy who had a huge following, and his name was PK something or other.
Okay.
And this was not your middle-class black crowd. This was a particular belligerent, we boo you if we don't like you. And I had no business being there, but I needed the $100.
Right.
And my manager at the time said, this is going to get 10 years of stage time under your belt in one night. So I knew I was in trouble when Godfrey, who's a really great comic, he's black, he was emceeing, and they started throwing things at him, calling him an Uncle Tom.
Whoa!
And then they booed somebody else who was also of color. So I went up, and...
Did you start doing Michael Richards' act? No, just kidding.
So I got up, and the crowd was like, what is she doing here? But they were going to give me a chance. And, of course, I started tanking immediately, and you can feel it implode on you. So they just started talking over me as if I weren't even there. So I remember saying, if you just shut up, and I'll get off the stage. I said, if you shut up and let me tell one joke, I will get off the stage. And immediately 400 people went silent, as if to say, we hate you that much.
Wow. Oy.
So I told my quick joke, and this one older fellow way at the back of the crowd, they let me tell one quick joke, and he stood up, and he had to be like pushing 70, and he said, now why don't you get the F off the stage before we have OJ take care of you too? And he got a round of huge applause, and everybody got up on their feet. So I kind of pretended they were applauding for me. So I just stood up and said, thank you guys so much. And I got off the stage, and it was very funny, and I got my $100.
Wow.
And I had no business being on that show anyway, because I was not polished.
Well,
I was in the apartment. But it was very, very funny.
Well, funny in retrospect, perhaps. I'm surprised you didn't join the Klan. Holy crap.
Yeah.
Now, I have to ask you, though. What quick joke did you tell?
I was going to tell a joke about credit card debt.
Okay. All right. Oh.
Nobody wanted to hear my stuff.
Oh, so you didn't even tell the joke. You didn't even get to tell the joke. He precluded you from doing that when they show. Oh, my God. Oh, good God. What about you, Al?
One of my original gigs, I paid a 7-year-old African-American man to heckle my wife on stage. but it was more than $50.
It was.
I have so many. Usually it involves a drunk person, a belligerent drunk person who comes in late and is just disrupts the audience. And then I crap on them, I guess I could say, and the crowd goes nuts, and they love it because they don't want that person in the room either. And then they would come in, they would grab the microphone out of my hand, and then security would come in and grapple them to the ground. And there's a bunch of those stories.
I don't
see those rooms anymore.
Wait, you're not joking about that? They would actually come to the stage if you pissed them off, and then try and assault you?
Well, yeah, they were drunk and belligerent, and they came in late, and they disrupted the show. And, of course, as a comedian, you know, you own the stage. It's your duty to defend the stage and the audience. And some of us can do it well, and some of us have trouble with that. I'm a seasoned comic, but you never want it to get that ugly. Usually shutting down a heckler is the best way to go, and most hecklers do shut down and will keep quiet, but... After doing this over 25 years, you do come across your incidents where it gets a little bit out of hand. And hopefully the comedy club is on top of it.
Now, Alan and Bernadette, I also want to ask, you've, as she said, been doing this for about 2 decades now. But do you both feel that you just missed the 80s, 90s comedy boom where everybody was doing comedy and 90% of the people were snapped up for TV and radio immediately and getting famous and gigs and everything? It just there was you came of age, I guess, in the crash after the comedy boom. Is that sort of true?
What's the percentage of everybody getting snatched up? Where are you getting your numbers from? Trump's campaign manager?
All right, okay. Well, all right. Maybe it felt like 90% because you would turn around and every new TV show would be starring a comedian. So,
well, there was in the late 80s and in the early 90s, there were a bunch of stand-up comedians that went on to either superstardom sitcoms or failed sitcoms. And there were a lot more failed sitcoms, or sitcoms that were never made, or sitcoms that were made and never saw the light of day, than the ones that pushed through. And, of course, we all know the big ones, the Seinfelds and the Tim Allen and the Kevin James, those guys. Yes, I mean, they were going after comedians because the comedian or the comedy community had grown during the boom so much so. You went from, you know, 1,000 or 1,200 working comedians who were doing it for a living to literally like 10,000 to 15,000 overnight. So the comedy festivals sprouted out. There were comedy clubs everywhere. Every restaurant turned their back room into a comedy venue.
Right, yeah.
And you could, I was kind of in the beginning of my career during the second wave, and literally I was working 2 or 3 shows a night, 7 nights a week for like 18 months straight. I was turning down gigs. It was that crazy.
Wow.
But it, you know, it seasoned me to be a better comic, so that when the boom was over, although I didn't have my sitcom, I've been able to eke out a comfortable living for a couple of decades. So only a few of us are able to do that. But yeah. I take pride in that.
Yeah, no, Muslim, I mean, that is a very tough thing to do. Nowadays, even 10, 20 years ago. I mean, have you guys done the pilot season thing where you go out there, try to get either sitcoms or dramatic shows or whatever the TV, or you don't even bother with that?
When I did a couple of the comedy festivals, I did the prestigious Montreal Comedy Festival.
Okay, yeah.
Shortly thereafter, I was being flown around by a couple of the networks, first class tickets, limousines, a bunch of people sitting around a table laughing at me or saying nothing funny, and checking to see if the executive producer was laughing. And then they go, okay, we want to move forward with this. And then I get the phone call saying, hey, everybody there was fired, and they're not going to go ahead with your project. So that happens a lot.
How do you deal, you know, it's one thing for actors and comedians to deal with bad crowds and rejection. How do you deal with that kind of higher disappointment, of like something's really going to happen and then it doesn't? How do you brace yourself for that?
You don't brace yourself. When it does happen and it becomes a reality, what you do is you get yourself back on the road and you just work on your act. And that's my therapy.
And you get yourself a cocktail.
Oh, yeah, a beverage, an adult beverage would help.
Well, do you guys have addictions? We were talking last week to a comedian who had a sexual fetish for people who were crippled or missing limbs. No joke. It was his, he confessed to this erotic fetish. What do you guys do that's your addiction that gets you through? Do you drink? Drugs? Stupping? Murder? What?
I think we're codependent with each other. We're addicted to our dog, to each other, and we probably booze too much.
Yeah, but it's wine. So it usually starts with a wine for dinner and then two more after that, and then there's a yawning and a passing out.
And that would do it. Now, speaking, you mentioned your doggy. You're kind of getting connected in some ways, Bernadette, with animal shows, pet shows. Is that evolving even more now?
Yeah, I guess it's been going on for some time. But, you know, as I travel and wherever I go, I pick up a new group or, you know, I end up having new venues ask me, hey, we're doing an animal charity, and you've got jokes about your dog, and I have T-shirts about my dog. And so, would you give us a nice charity rate? And I'm always happy to do it, because as long as I know the money's really going, I always check out the source. Mm. And make sure it's legit and that the money's not going towards somebody's Bentley. And as long as it's really going to help the animals, I'm always happy to do it. Makes me feel good.
So what do you foresee for both of you? And I'm not talking on the personal level. I'm talking on the professional level, like the next 10 years. What do you expect? Do you expect to still just be on the road? Do you hope to be involved in another sit-down TV gig? What do you hope for?
All the above.
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
I feel very fortunate, and success, how is success measured? I'm doing what I love to do. I travel the world. I meet wonderful people and only a couple of idiots out of that. And I'm doing what I love to do. And yes, would it be nice to have the big show that goes into syndication after 5 seasons? Sure. But being able to do what I do is gratifying, but I always want more.
Well, wait, but let me ask you, though. I'll get to it in a moment, Bernadette, but I want to follow up on that, because you do a lot of commercials, Al. Isn't that the best paycheck? I mean, if that goes national, isn't that like having a syndicated TV show or not? Or is that overstating the case? Like, if you suddenly see someone on a commercial all the time, you think they're making millions.
Well, it's all about following and how much. Television pays a lot. You don't have to travel nearly as much if you're on a television show, and more people will come to see you because of the exposure that you have. So, I would like to probably travel a little less and make more money.
Yeah, we'd like to work a little less and make more. Isn't that what everybody wants?
Is that unusual?
Yeah, no, but what I'm saying is about the commercials. If you land a commercial, is that like enough to pay for you guys for a year or 6 months or... Or is it overrated, you know, our commercial, you make a nice check, but it isn't like 10 years of your life paid for?
Well, first of all, the landscape of the residuals and such has changed so much. Back in the 90s, commercial residuals were paying much better, and I had a couple of national commercials running where the checks would just come in weekly, sometimes daily, and that enabled me to put me in a better financial situation to acquire property and also to travel a little less for a couple of years, sure, but you can't sit on your laurels in anything. And so, yes, you have, it's a roller coaster as far as your finances go. You have banner years and you have, you know, bleak years, and you just have to be able to be smart about managing.
I have tried singing on my laurels. It's worse than singing on my keys, let me tell you. Now, Bernadette, your hopes or your future ideas or desires, same things, essentially?
We have a podcast, BernieAndAlPodcast.com. I'd like to get that
on
the platforms and take it up with sponsorship. You know, I always like to have multiple sources of income, because no matter what in this business, it doesn't matter who you are, you can win an Academy Award, and you have to look for work the next day.
Yeah, they say Academy Award sometimes is a curse. You can't get work after that. Interesting.
I mean, it's a very, very strange business. But it has been a delightful business talking with Al Ducharme and Bernadette Pauly. Remember, you can see them both on Long Island in separate places tonight. One of them is going to be in the brokerage. The other in the brokerage is in Belmore, Long Island. And then you've got the, Governor's, right? In Bohemia.
Governor's chain, and I'll be at McGuire's in Bohemia.
McGuire's in Bohemia. That is both tonight, this evening, Saturday night. I want to, first of all, thank you both so much. And you both have that, what is it, BernieAndAlPodcast.com is the place?
Yeah, it's BernieAndAl.com.
BernieAndAl.com. Yes?
Exactly.
Cool. Now, last question for you both, and the question I'm sure everybody asks, I always ask comedians, is, who were your influences when you were coming up? What comedians did you watch way back when and you said, oh, I can do that or I can do that better, or man, I hope to do that someday? And also, who do you like now?
Jerry Seinfeld made a big impression on me on his Tonight Show appearances. And prior to that, it could have been a little bit of Robin Williams. And even before that, when I was a small child, Jonathan Winters was always a zany.
Yeah.
Zany guy. I heard he was zany in real life, too.
And what about you, Bernadette?
I've always really enjoyed watching Chris Rock like crazy, for whatever reason. He tends to move me a little bit more than most when people want me to single somebody out. And I always went crazy over Carol Burnett when I was a little kid.
Oh.
It didn't occur to me. Yeah, I would always watch the stand-up at late-night TV shows. I was mesmerized by them, but it never occurred to me that I would be one. I don't know why, until later in life. So, and the ones I just remember seeing were old clips of... I remember loving Pryor and Carlin, but not really understanding them, but just being really young and...
And hearing those records. It was almost like listening to a rock record album back in the day, when you would get a Carlin album or a Pryor or a Robert Klein. You were just listening, and even if the joke didn't make you laugh, there was something about the rhythm, the choice of words, the moment the audience got it and laughed, that you would just be learning from it while you were listening to it. At least that's what
Exactly.
Well, I hope you guys become Carlin and Pryor and Klein and me, for example. Just throw myself in there. But I wish you both much... Of course, Stiller and Mirror, too. That is true. Let me ask you, how much do you do together and how much apart?
60-40.
60-40, you travel... Do you ever do... I mean, obviously you do the podcast together. Do you tag team comedy together live, or no, you don't do that?
Oh, yeah. Yes, we do. Well, last night we performed together. We were both at the brokerage, but tonight we're splitting up.
But when you do the brokerage, does one of you take the stage, do half an hour, then the other comes out, or you're literally on the stage at the same time?
One takes the stage. I'm on first, he's on second, and then sometimes I end up back on stage with him for a few minutes of riffing.
Cool. Yeah. Because that is kind of rare to see that. You know, usually stand-up is one person at the mic. There are these two guys, I unfortunately do not remember their names, but they're very, very funny, and they do comedy together. Like, they work stand-up together. And it's so different. What are their names? Do you remember? Who are they?
Two guys who do it. There's the Sklar Brothers. There's
That's
a handful of people who do it, right?
Yeah, the Sklar Brothers. Very, very funny. And it's they're funny anyway, but just the idea of hearing these two people going back and forth is so unusual that it adds something, I think. And it adds something to talk to both of you, Al Ducharme and Bernadette Pauly, here in the neighborhood. Please go to see them tonight on Long Island. Go check out their individual websites and their website together. And I thank you both for being with us.
Thank you for having us on. That's wonderful.
You're most welcome.
Yeah, thank you so much. Have a great Memorial Day weekend.
Shalom and drive safely. Bye-bye now.